Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken? A podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
Union calendar number 282, H.R. 2372, a bill to provide jurisdiction and procedures for claims to compensate payments for injuries due to exposure to radiation from nuclear testing.
June 5th, 1990. The House of Representatives debates the Radiation Exposure Compensation Act, also known as RECA. Utah Democrat Wayne Owens sponsored the bill.
The haste of building and testing U.S. nuclear weapons led to increased cancers and leukemias and the deaths of hundreds of Americans who trusted their government and participated in what they perceived to be a patriotic duty.
For more than 40 years, 1944 to 1986, nearly 30 million tons of uranium ore were mined from Navajo land to make nuclear weapons. More than 200 atomic bombs were set off at the Nevada testing site.
Called Doomtown, the buildings and their contents will test the effect of the bomb at distances ranging from 1 to 2 miles. The extent to which food will be contaminated by radioactivity will also be studied, along with the effect of blast on communications.
Well, those tests spread toxic radiation throughout the region and across state lines. Most residents and the workers weren't warned of the dangers. Many Navajo people fell sick and died. And the effects of that radiation exposure persist to this day. The first bill setting up a compensation plan for the workers was proposed back in 1979, and it took more than a decade to pass. That brings us back to 1990, where, with bipartisan support, RECA made it through Congress and was signed into law. Republican Representative Barbara Vukinovich of Nevada.
Legislation and money can never right the wrong, restore lost family members, or make these victims victimless. However, it can help make life a little easier. Mr. Speaker, I urge my colleagues to support this measure and support the closing of an open chapter in the sometimes unfair and unfortunate history of our nation.
RECA provided a one-time lump sum for workers sickened by the uranium mining. A decade later, amendments added more people, including uranium millers and more downwinders, to the list of beneficiaries. Now, more than 20 years have since passed, with no further amendments. And now, that compensation fund is set to expire this July if Congress does not act to extend it. People or their living heirs sickened by Cold War-era radiation exposure risk losing coverage for their health expenses. So lawmakers are again faced with the very question posed by Republican Representative John Rhodes III of Arizona back in 1990.
How do we respond when the federal government injures its own innocent citizens and the courts are not equipped to provide an adequate remedy?
We did not know anything about this hazardous material or didn't even explain it to us. And now half of those miners are dead. Some of them were still young.
Leslie Begay lives in Coyote Canyon, New Mexico, on the Navajo Nation. He was 21, had served in Vietnam when he started working in the uranium mines in 1983.
It was just, you know, the rain jacket, safety glasses, and a hard hat. That's it. That's all we had. Nothing else. It wouldn't even matter. Even if you're wearing a space suit, they'll still get on you.
No face masks. No gas masks, no oxygen tanks. The mining shafts had little to no ventilation. So the miners constantly inhaled toxic dust and air. Leslie was even drinking the water from the mines, never knowing it was dangerous. He worked in uranium mining until 1991. Almost a quarter century later, in 2015, he felt that something wasn't quite right.
So we went to the hospital and right away, you know, they noticed that there was a problem with me. They sent me to Albuquerque. There was a lung doctor that noticed that I had a serious problem. They've asked me many questions, see if I was smoking, see if I was go on drugs. I said, no, I haven't. I've never done those things or drinking, you know. I said, but I have worked in uranium mine.
Doctors informed Leslie that radiation exposure could have severely damaged his health. It was the first time he'd ever been told this. Days later, at age 60, Leslie was diagnosed with interstitial lung disease. The lung scarring, difficulty breathing, getting oxygen into his blood are all irreversible. The most common cause of ILD is long-term exposure to hazardous materials. Leslie was given medication and oxygen tanks.
You know, there's time that, you know, I have to hook up both of them. You know, I used to carry two of them to keep my oxygen level that high. I used to go through 42 bottles a week.
That's 42 bottles of oxygen a week. Leslie sees a lung specialist every 6 months, but the closest specialists to the Navajo Nation are 3 to 6 hours away. None of Leslie's doctor visits, medication, and oxygen are covered by RECA, that congressional law. He does not qualify for federal compensation simply because of when he started working in the mines. According to the statute, only those exposed to radiation between 1944 and 1971 qualify, even though uranium mining continued for another 15 years. Leslie started mining in 1983.
I just don't see any difference of what they have done before as far as protection-wise. There was no more, no add-on than what the past people have done. None, not whatsoever. I could see if it was, you know, a full suit, you know, maybe with the oxygen to breathe better air. That could have been worked all right. Yeah, none of that. I mean, the past miners and us miners, there's nothing different that has changed. Nothing. We did what they did.
Congress created the eligibility cutoff because, in 1971, the federal government was no longer the sole purchaser of uranium extracted from the mines. Therefore, lawmakers saw the government as no longer solely accountable for worker health. Leslie Begay thinks that's a weak excuse. In September, he received a double lung transplant. He's recovering, but has to take 20 pills a day. And without health benefits from the VA, recall, he served in the United States military in Vietnam. Without those VA benefits, he could have never afforded the treatments. Even with that coverage, though, Leslie says he's barely getting by.
I don't know why the government thinks of us so low, that like we're nothing, you know, that we didn't do nothing. We provided them this warhead, you know, and stuff like that. We're somebody. We are somebody. And we're being forgotten. I don't know how to, you know, get into an avenue for them to hear us, our situation. We're talking about human lives. I think about my people, you know. I think about people that have lost their fathers, you know, their brothers, and so on, that we're still dying off of it. I'm paying like close to $700 a month on my medication. I'm down to like nothing, you know. I'm down to like nothing now, you know. And nobody to help me, nobody to support me. I mean, what we're all going through. And I hope they, you know, that they would understand us and give us what we deserve. This is a long time overdue.
Leslie Begay. He's 67 now, and with his new lungs, he plans to fly to Washington later this month to advocate for RECA coverage for all post-1971 uranium mine workers. Now, joining us is Phil Harrison of Kirkland, New Mexico. He's advocated for compensation for these communities for over 40 years. He's the former president and now senior consultant of the Navajo Uranium Radiation Victims Committee. And he joins us again from Kirkland, New Mexico. Mr. Harrison, welcome to you. So, folks, As you can hear, today we have been having some significant technical troubles. I'll be perfectly honest with you. In the hour before our show, we had some internet breakdowns and failures, and those seems to have spread to actually our control room, where our mic isn't working, our music is acting erratically, and we can't connect. But we're going to take a quick break here. We'll talk a lot more, if we can, and I trust we'll be able to, when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. And if you ever doubted that this show is done live, doubt no more. Our terrific team behind the glass in the control room has, for now, fixed the entire gamut of technical problems. But let's get back to the reason why we've all come together today, and that is to talk about the fight for compensation for the long-term health effects of high amounts of radiation exposure suffered by the Navajo people due to 40 years of uranium mining on Navajo land in order to build nuclear weapons. So Phil Harrison joins us. He's former president and now senior consultant with the Navajo Uranium Radiation Victims Committee. He's advocated on this issue for more than 40 years, a member of the Navajo Nation, and was also an underground uranium miner. He's with us from Kirkland, New Mexico. Mr. Harrison, welcome to you.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. And also with us today is Amber Crotty. She's joining us from Sheep Springs, New Mexico, on the Navajo Nation. She's been a Navajo Nation Council delegate for 8 years. Ms. Crotty, welcome to you. Going to still work on that one. Okay. So Mr. Harrison, first of all, can you describe to us, how many members of the Navajo Nation have suffered health impacts, or how broad are the health impacts from those 40 years of uranium mining and testing, by the way, on Navajo land?
Yes, I'm not sure. The last time that we talked about this was like about a little over 5,000 Navajo uranium workers that participated in either mining or milling. And the Public Health Service has studied like about 740 Navajo uranium workers. And I'm not sure exactly how many we're talking about that had engaged in this the Cold War efforts. So people had different representation by some by attorneys and some by the tribal office and some by individuals. So we really don't know how many miners had done mining.
I see. Now, you also worked in the mines. How long did you work there?
I was a high school in my senior year. I worked down in a place called Gateway, Colorado, up the John Brown Canyon. And I worked like 4 months, and I was helping my father underground. And if I was not cleaning the tracks, I was helping the drillers and replenishing supplies that they use. So I did work like about four months underground, and my father got sick. And then I went left from there, and I enlisted in the military, and I came back and worked a remediation site in Tuba City. under Department of Energy for almost 2 years, being exposed to surface contaminated materials.
Uh-huh. Okay. So, you know, in the previous segment, we briefly told the story of how Congress passed RECA in order to create a system of compensation for people who are suffering from the effects of the radiation poisoning, essentially, of their bodies. But even before that, I mean, there was this long battle in order to get the federal government to recognize that some kind of compensation was necessary. Can you tell us a little bit about you had originally worked on a case, a lawsuit against the federal government, in the early 1980s to get that recognition? Can you tell us that story?
Yes, I got involved from a community meeting where members of the Red Valley chapter in the northeastern state of Arizona. There is a community chapter house there. So the issue came out back then. The late Stuart Udall was the attorney, and they created a lawsuit called Begay versus Kermit Gee. And then, honestly, it didn't go anywhere. So the focus turned on the congressional efforts back in the late 70s and into 80s. So it was it took a lot of years to create that first compensation law in 1990.
Hmm. Okay. So then tell us exactly what is going to happen this summer in July with RECA that could have an impact on so many people.
First of all, we have worked behind the scenes, working with the local leaders, the state, county, and Southwest congressional offices. There's two things that we're trying to do. Is we're trying to extend the sunset of Department of Justice in Washington, which expires July of 2022. And we worked on that first. And now that we have heard that today, the House of Representatives will be voting on that. So we'd like to see that be extended because of the coronavirus, where many of these miners and downwinders, they were not being seen by the hospitals. There was no appointments and everybody just sheltered in place. So we lost a good 2 years, and that's the reason why that we wanted this extension. So we do have a good excuse for this to happen. Mm. Secondly, is that we want to stay focused to amend the RECA Law 2000 to include people like post 71 workers, and that is a big focus right now, and we want to see that happen. It's taken us a long, long time, and there's got to be some empathy from the U.S. Congress, you know, to get this done for first responders during the Cold War.
I see. Okay, so first of all, the interruption that the COVID pandemic brought in terms of people's ability to access care. On that note, Mr. Harrison, let's listen to Jennifer McCall. She's a senior paralegal who deals with all RECA claims for a law firm in Grand Junction, Colorado. And she says her clients have been calling in a panic, trying to get paperwork filed before, again, the July 11th sunset date for potential sunset date for this legislation. And she says that because of the pandemic, the required paperwork for many of her clients has been more or less impossible to get.
I think it's a horrible time for it to end. I don't think it's fair to these workers. It's not fair to the downwind on-site people. It's not fair to them that because a law that was enacted is all of a sudden going to stop when we've got over 2 years of time that we weren't able to file claims. We weren't able to put them together. I've got a couple sitting here on the desk that are just coming together now. And I've had these clients for some time. A lot of times it just takes time to get everything put together. And now with the government not releasing records like we need, I think they should at least give us 2 years extension on it, if not five.
Again, she's talking about 2 to 5 year extension on the RECA legislation, which is set to sunset on July 11th. And by the way, Jennifer McCall told us that 400 of the claims she's trying to manage right now are from members of the Navajo Nation. Well, let's turn to Amber Crotty, who I believe we finally do have now, a Navajo Nation Council delegate for 8 years. Ms. Crotty, welcome to you.
Thank you. This is Amber Canesbaugh Crotty, and if I may introduce myself to my relatives, Kia Ani Nishle do Bilagana Bashis Chin Des Chini Deshe do. Thank you very much for providing an opportunity for us to speak about our efforts when it comes to the Radiation Exposure Compensation Act, also known as RECA.
Well, Amber's joining us from Sheep Springs, New Mexico on the Navajo Nation, and we need to spend a little bit of time talking about really the extent of the health impacts that the uranium mining and the nuclear testing have had intergenerationally, because I'm seeing some pretty, extraordinary numbers, studies that show that more than 35% of Navajo men, more than a quarter of Navajo women in Navajo Nation have concentrations of uranium, for example, in their bodies that exceed any level found in the highest 5% of people exposed in the United States. Now, I mean, there's also been other studies, like a birthing cohort study. Mm-hmm. So can you talk about that, Amber?
Yes, thank you. So in our efforts on Navajo Nation and how we look at the impact of not only uranium extraction, the direct impact on our uranium miners, we know, and through the stories of, like you heard from Leslie, that these miners were not equipped to protect themselves. And so when they returned home to their families were then exposed. We have homes that were built with radioactive material. We have children of miners and surviving spouses who now have trace elements of uranium in their bodies. We can now see at a very cellular level how this has impacted the composition of a Navajo body. And what we're looking for in terms of not only talking about the severe health disparities of our Navajo miners themselves, but also the surviving spouses, their children, and how we're seeing that this legacy of uranium did not end in 1971. Mm. And we continue to need to provide that for the families.
So can you tell me a little bit more then, again, I mentioned this earlier, but to make it clear for listeners, the coverage, the eligibility coverage stops for after 1971 in terms of miners who worked in the mines until 1971. Who else is currently eligible?
So in terms of some of the downwinders, what we're finding are certain states were selected. And what is a concern to Navajo Nation is parts of our territories is in the New Mexico side of the nation. And those relatives who have shown and we've demonstrated, we have open uranium mines, we have downwinders from the explosions that have happened, to not have our New Mexico citizens and Americans and Navajo Nation citizens be covered under this Compensation Act is a real disservice. And those are areas where our congressional leadership needs to understand there are segments of our population that have not been covered, have not been justly compensated, and not have been able to access the medical relief that is needed for these for their recovery. And hopefully, you know, to end and get the medical help that they need to live a life that we all aspire to.
Mm. Well, so we've spoken to a number of people to help give us as broad an understanding of the health impacts. I mean, Amber, you mentioned the intergenerational impacts with babies being born already with evidence of uranium exposure in their bodies. Well, we also spoke with Caitlin Kelly Reef, an epidemiologist at the U.S. National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health, or NIOSH. She's the principal investigator of several chronic disease studies involving workers who are exposed to ionizing radiation. And she recently did a study on a group of uranium miners from Colorado who worked in the mines from 1950 to 1960. And her team looked at the death rates of the uranium miners compared to death rate statistics of U.S. males alive at the same age and at the same time as the miners. So she took a look at lung diseases that were non-malignant. She looked at interstitial pulmonary fibrosis, which, by the way, Leslie Begay has. You heard from him earlier. She also looked at pneumoconiosis and silicosis. Okay, so from the study period between 1960 to 2016, she found that the interstitial pulmonary fibrosis rate, the mortality rate for uranium miners, was 380% higher than the rest of the population. For pneumoconiosis, it was 3,800% higher. And for silicosis, it was 4,040% higher. And Kelly Reef says, obviously, these results are staggering.
I think the main public health takeaway from our study is that uranium miners are still dying of these compensatable diseases, and the data suggests that uranium miners will continue to die of compensatable diseases after RECA ends.
After RECA ends. And Kelly Reef also says that one of the major takeaways is that there's a latency period, a long latency period between the exposure to the uranium radiation and the emergence of health impacts. Well, we also spoke with Doug Briggy. He's the author of The History of Uranium Mining and the Navajo People, a report that was published in the American Public Health Journal back in 2002. And Briggy concluded, quote, "This history details how the federal government deliberately avoided dealing with a health disaster among Navajo uranium miners, even though uranium mining was considered very much a federal matter."
It was obvious decades before mining of uranium for atomic purposes began that uranium mining was hazardous. It's also clear to me that the cause, the reason why it was hazardous, was apparent right at the start of the atomic age. And from that flowed a logical conclusion, which is to reduce the radon exposures mostly through ventilation. That wasn't done very well until very late, and that contributed to the particularly high toll paid by uranium miners in the early stages of the atomic developments.
And more specifically, Briggy's report states, quote, "Federal regulations for ventilation came nearly 20 years after the need was clear, and only when many miners were obviously sick and dying." Phil Harrison, do you want to respond to that about this long period of essentially knowledge on the part of the federal government of the health effects and the long period between that and at least some of the actions that have been taken?
Yes, I'm involved with hundreds of former Navajo uranium workers and other people. A lot of them say that they were not warned about the dangers and serious consequences of being exposed to mining and milling. And I mentioned earlier that I work underground for 4 months, and I was just given a shovel and told to keep the tracks clear and help the drillers. And nobody told me how dangerous this is going to be. And I drank water every day. It was almost a homemade cistern system that was existing in these mines where you just go there like a water fountain and take 2 or 3 cups of water and then go back to your workstation. And this has been going on for pre-71 and post-71. The post-71 miners are telling me that there's no clean mine and post-71 mines. And they were very dirty, and people were sent to daylight when they were told that they were exposed with that working level right. months.
Well, Phil Harrison, stand by here for just a second, if you could, please, and Amber Crotty as well. We're talking this hour about the ongoing effort to guarantee and expand coverage for the long-term health effects suffered by members of the Navajo Nation due to 40 years of uranium mining on Navajo land. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're talking about the ongoing efforts to both preserve and expand what's known as the Radiation Exposure Compensation Act, or RECA. It's a 1990 law that finally got around to providing compensation and aid for members of the Navajo Nation and people who used to work in the uranium mines on Navajo land that were, for 40 years, pulling uranium out of the ground in order to make nuclear weapons. Now, Democratic Senator Ben Ray Lujan of New Mexico is one of the main advocates for RECA expansion. By the way, again, as we mentioned earlier, RECA is set to sunset July of this year. A vote may prevent that sunsetting, but advocates are looking to expand who gets coverage. Now, Lujan introduced legislation on this issue every session since he first took office in 2009. All his efforts have so far failed. Now, Lujan's father died of stage 4 lung cancer because of an exposure on the job as a welder. And the stories he hears from his constituents keep him fighting, including one he likes to share with his fellow colleagues.
I often tell them about a story of an elder Navajo woman who came to testify in Congress and shared the ailments her families were facing. But her testimony, I think, is as powerful as anything I could tell them. And what she asked us as elected House members is the federal government waiting for all of us to die so that the problem goes away?
Well, many of his constituents that he's worked with on this issue have died. This session, Senator Lujan tried again and introduced another RECA expansion proposal, but it never made it to the Senate floor. He also co-sponsored legislation to extend RECA for 2 years after its July sunset date. And as we heard earlier, the measure unanimously passed the Senate in April and is up for a vote in the House this week. But if the extension doesn't pass, Lujan says a door for the families affected will be closed forever.
Without the United States stepping forward to recognize that families sacrificed so very much at a time that the United States depended on the development of these weapons, then some of these families, they're going to die at a faster rate. They're not going to have resources to take care of them or avenues to pursue to help not just themselves, but their families. And again, it's plain to me that this is an issue that was created by the United States government. The United States should admit liability here and extend the program.
By the way, when he says it was created by the United States government, the history of this is tragic and fascinating. The Manhattan Project actually formed a front company. They called it the United Mines Development Corporation when they were first searching for places to pull uranium out of the ground. It was, again, a front company because no one was supposed to know about it. And they found it on Navajo land. Now, Lujan has an even bigger goal, expanding coverage to include more uranium workers, more downwinders, as well as additional qualifying illnesses to really cover the true extent of impact from radiation exposure. But he keeps getting pushback on one thing, the cost. Now, the biggest opposition to this legislative session came from Republican Representative Jim Jordan of Ohio. So here he is in a House Judiciary meeting on the expansion bill back in December.
This bill also more than doubles the compensation paid to certain existing claimants, likely costing taxpayers more than $2.8 billion. And that's before anyone in the newly covered areas receives any compensation for medical benefits.
And here's how Senator Lujan told us he responds.
Well, let's go travel to New Mexico and you can visit with those Navajo elder women and you can tell them to their face that this is too expensive. You know, no one's taking me up on that offer, but it's one of those areas that unfortunately, I think politically, especially, we've seen a lack of willingness to support and sometimes outright initiatives to block this particular legislation.
Whereas Congress, both Republicans and Democrats, regularly show a willingness to support and spend vastly more in other areas related to defense. Recall, the uranium was mined out of the earth on Navajo land to build weapons. Navajo people have been sickened doing that work and their families on behalf of national security. So here's another way to look at it. In the 32 years since RECA passed, the government has awarded $2.5 billion on approved claims for people suffering radiation exposure due to the mining and its impact. So again, $2.5 billion total over more than 30 years. Whereas just last year, Congress readily approved $4.9 billion for just 1 year of spending on intercontinental ballistic missiles, more than $10 billion on ballistic submarine missiles. Again, that's almost $15 billion for two missile systems for a single year, and it's a figure that will likely continue to be approved year after year until the weapon systems are retired. So Senator Lujan is frustrated, but he's optimistic as well. Since he entered Congress in 2009, RECA expansion legislation has more co-sponsors today and bipartisan co-sponsors than ever before. So he does make one thing clear. Future uranium mining projects and even cleanup from past uranium mining should not happen, he says, until RECA expansion goes through.
During those debates, I said, what about the cleanup that needs to take place with someone fighting for their lives with cancer? No one's talking about them. That's why I think that whether we're talking about cleanup, storage, or new projects, RECA needs to be addressed and these families need our help. And that should be front and center for anyone. And folks that have come talk to me, that's how I start the conversation and often how I end the conversation.
Democratic Senator Ben Ray Lujan of New Mexico. We spoke with him earlier this week. Amber Crotty, if I may return back to you. First of all, just to make something clear to listeners, Senator Lujan talked about cleanup. The EPA is at work doing cleanup of some of the sites of known high levels of uranium radiation. Is that right, Amber?
Yes, we've received some activity when it comes to the cleanup efforts. I represent communities that have been directly impacted. What the challenges and the conversations that are still taking place is what do we do with that radioactive material? And so we've had public meetings and the public and the community are saying, we do not want these radioactive materials left in our homelands. We want them safely removed. They're contaminating our water, our livestock, our plants, our way of life. And we continue to have that conversation, but it's only a minimal amount of mines that have been identified. There's still hundreds more than the 500 uranium sites that still have not been cleaned up. And that is still what we're pushing for in providing this public awareness on how the legacy of uranium has impacted the Navajo Nation and how, and I appreciate Senator Lujan's words, is what do we need to do as a nation to recognize that the sacrifice of national security and the sacrifice of nuclear power has come at a human cost, and that human, that Navajos are human, that the people of the land are human, and that we need to correct this.
Phil Harrison, we heard about, you know, cost being one of the primary reasons why there's resistance to expanding the legislation or eligibility for compensation. But also in the original legislation from 1990, that cutoff date of 1971, I want to explore that a little bit more because, you know, the federal government argues after that it was no longer the sole purchaser, right, of the uranium being mined out of the ground. And so, therefore, I wonder if are there other efforts right now to seek compensation for from the other companies that were involved in the continuing extraction of uranium? And has there been any effort or any successes on that front?
For all I know, I think there is a big effort that's being worked on by several groups that includes the Utah and Idaho and Montana downwinders. And I think everybody's focusing on expanding for 2 years with the RECA sunset and also focusing on the amendment. And I'm not sure there was workman's compensation that was mentioned for post-71 workers, and nobody knows about workman's compensation, and the statute of limitations have run out on a lot of these post-71 miners. So I'm not sure if there was any other efforts, but right now we're focusing on trying to get this law amended, and hopefully that will be in Washington soon to educate and provide expert witnessing to some of our Republican leaders in the House side. So that's coming forth soon.
Amber Crotty, I wanted to give you a chance to also respond to that. Do you see the circle of accountability as being wider than the federal government?
I think as a Navajo Nation, and just speaking specifically to our unique relationship with the government, as a treaty tribe and the government being our trustee, that our efforts right now is focused on the U.S. government in their role in contracting. If you don't know the history of Navajo Nation, the federal government plays a large part in developing these contracts for the Navajo Nation when they explained it to our tribal council and the language barriers. So at no point were we fully free informed consent. And without understanding the impacts and the devastating how uranium impacts the human body and the land and the water that was known at the time, the federal government and their agents brought this initiative to Navajo Nation and did not fully provide the protection. And so we look to the government as the sole responsibility and the entity that needs to correct this.
I wonder, you know, when the Cold War, quote unquote, ended, do you feel that the urgency around, you know, the attention that was paid to nuclear weapons, to then and also therefore the health effects suffered by the people who worked to get that uranium out of the ground, just kind of faded away, and it became, I don't know how to put this, so forgive me if I'm putting it the wrong way, but like in the eyes of the federal government, it just sort of it became a quote unquote Navajo problem. And that is that one of the things that's made it hard to expand the true circle of coverage for how many people have actually suffered an impact here.
Right. So I appreciate that. And it's not just a Navajo problem. This is an American problem.
Right.
Because this also not only the amount of impact on Navajo is this layered because of the uranium, the impact on the miners, not having the adequate medical attention, not having the education on how this will impact our children, knowing now that when our children are born, there's complexities, and not having the support in our education system to help those families. But it's also a regional. And I think hearing, the representative from Ohio is understanding that he and his constituents benefited from the sacrifice that was that happened here on Navajo and surrounding miners, like in Grants and working with Senator Crapo and the downwinders, and that has a human aspect to it. And in terms of just looking at what is the just compensation, what is the investment in the medical field to make sure that they're not suffering. My grandfather's a surviving uranium miner. And to see him struggle and battle for every breath, it's offensive that congressional leadership would not understand. And I'm not looking for empathy. I'm looking for justice. I'm looking to for that our nation that we entered into a treaty with to live up to their treaty obligation, and for those other non-Navajo miners in different states and their families to get what they need.
Yeah, because I'm glad that you made that that point just now, Amber, because, again, just to really talk about the extent of the mining over those 40 years, we've been focused on the Navajo because, you know, more than 1,000 of the mines or claims are on Navajo land, but there were 4,000 uranium mines total across the western United States affecting other tribes like the Hopi, Arapaho, Southern Cheyenne, the Spokane, the Laguna Pueblo as well. So this is a broad problem impacting many, many people and many tribes as well. Phil Harrison, we've got not that much time left, I'm afraid. Can you talk a little bit about is there a coalition between all the tribes to continue to advocate for for the compensation?
Yes, for all the years that I have done this advocacy for the Cold War victims, there is a coalition of other tribes that we reached out to, and they're all in the same struggle. And I think we're all focusing on, you know, what the problem that needs to be corrected. And federal government has the liability, as Amber said, that, you know, they have this treaty obligations. And we are all working together to get this whole thing corrected for justice.
Yeah. And, you know, one more thing. As far as I understand, you know, I keep thinking about what Leslie Begay told us earlier, that it wasn't until he was 60 years old and a quarter century past the time he worked in the mines that someone first told him that radiation exposure could be, deadly, essentially. But the federal government had studied it and documented the dangers specifically regarding the mining, right? And kept it secret. Is that right, Phil?
Like I said, nobody was ever told about the serious consequences of being exposed to radiation, either in mining or milling. And people at the same age, they did not engage in mining. They're healthy. In my community, we have over 400 men that died. This is back in Cove, Arizona, where the mine boom was 1950 to 1966. And we lost over 400 men from that community.
Well, Phil Harrison, former president and now senior consultant with the Navajo Uranium Radiation Victims Committee, with us today from Kirkland, New Mexico. Mr. Harrison, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And Amber Crotty, a member of the Navajo Nation Council, she's a council delegate for the Navajo Nation, with us from Sheep Springs, New Mexico. Amber Crotty, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you for just helping us amplify this story. Thank you.
And once again, the House is set to vote on whether or not to prevent the sunsetting of the RICO legislation this week. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful. and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.